Mars, Cassette 12. He flew back to Sabashi. There was still a lot of work to be done there, clearing away burned buildings and then building new ones. Some construction co-ops were still accepting new members. One was doing reconstruction, but was also building blimps and other flyers, including some experimental bird suits. He talked with them about joining. He left his blimp glider in town with them and took long runs out onto the high moors east of Sabashii. He had run these uplands during his student years. A lot of the ridge runs were familiar still. Beyond them, new ground. A high land with its moorish life. Big, commie boulders stood here and there on the rumpled land, like sentinels. One afternoon, running an unfamiliar ridge, he looked down into a small high basin like a shallow bowl with a break opening to lower land to the west. Like a glacial cirque, though more likely it was an eroded crater with a break in its rim making a horseshoe ridge. About a kilometer across, quite shallow. Just a rumple among the many rumples on the Tarina Massif. From the encircling ridge, the horizons were far away, the land below lumpy and irregular. It seemed familiar. Possibly he had visited it on an overnighter in his student years. He hiked slowly down into the basin and still felt like he was on top of the massif. Something about the dark, clean indigo of the sky, the spacious, long view out the gap to the west. Clouds rolled overhead like great rounded icebergs, dropping dry granular snow which was chased into cracks or out of the basin entirely by the hard wind. On the circling ridge, near the northwest point of the horseshoe, there was a boulder sitting like a stone hut. It stood on four points on the ridge, a dolmen worn to the smoothness of an old tooth. The sky over it lapis lazuli. Nergal walked back down to Sabashii and looked into the matter. The basin was untended according to the maps and records of the Tarina Massif Areography and Ecopoesis Council. They were pleased he was interested. "The high basins are hard," they told him. "Very little grows. It's a long project." "Good. You'll have to grow most of your food in greenhouses. Potatoes, however, once you get enough soil, of course." Nergal nodded. They asked him to drop by the village of Dingpoche, the one nearest the basin, and make sure no one there had plans for it. So he drove back up in a little caravan with Tariki and Rachel and Tiyu and some other friends who had gathered to help. They drove over a low ridge and found Dingpoche set on a little wadi that was now being farmed, mostly in hardscrabble potato fields. There had been a snowstorm, and all the fields were white rectangles divided by low black walls of stacked stones. A number of long, low stone houses with plate rock roofs and thick square chimneys were scattered among the fields, with several more clustered at the village's upper end. The longest building in this cluster was a two-storied tea house with a big mattress-filled room to accommodate visitors. In Dingpoche, as in much of the southern highlands, the gift economy still predominated, and Nergal and his companions had to endure a near potlatching when they stayed for the night. The locals were very happy when he inquired about the high basin, which they called variously the Little Horseshoe or the Upper Hand. "It needs looking after." They offered to help him get started. So they went up to the high cirque in a little caravan and dumped a load of gear on the ridge nearest the house boulder and stuck around long enough to clear a first little field of stones, walling it with what they cleared. A couple of them, experienced in construction, helped him to make the first incisions into the ridge boulder. During this noisy drilling, some of the Dingpoche locals cut away at the exterior of the rock, carving in Sanskrit lettering, "Om Mani Padme Hum," as seen on innumerable Mani stones in the Himalayas and now all over the southern highlands. The locals chipped away the rock between the fat cursive letters so that the letters stood out in raised relief against a rougher, lighter background. As for the Boulder house itself, eventually he would have four rooms hacked out of the boulder, with triple-paned windows, solar panels for heat and power, water from a snowmelt pumped up to a tank placed higher on the ridge, and a composting toilet and gray water facility. Then they were off. Nergal had the basin to himself. He walked around on it for many days without doing anything but looking. Only the tiniest part of the basin would be his farm, just some small fields inside low stone walls and a greenhouse for vegetables. And a cottage industry, he wasn't sure what. It wouldn't be self-sufficient, but it would be settling in. A project. And then there was the basin itself. A small channel already ran down the opening out to the west, as if to suggest a watershed. The cupped hand of rock was already a microclimate, tilted to the sun, slightly sheltered from the winds. He would be an echo poet. First he had to learn the land. With that as his project, it was amazing how busy every day became. There was an endless number of things to do, but no structure, no schedule, no rush, no one to consult. And every day, in the last hours of summer light, he would walk around the ridge and inspect the basin in the failing light. It was already colonized by Lycan and the other first settlers. Fell fields filled the hollows, and there were small mosaics of Arctic ground cover in the sunny exposures, mounds of green moss humped on red soil less than a centimeter thick. Snowmelt coursed down a number of rivulet channels, pooling and dropping through any number of potential meadow terraces, little diatom oases, falling down the basin to meet in the gravel wadi at the gate to the land below, a flat meadow to be behind the residual rim. Ribs higher in the basin were natural dams, and after some consideration, Nergal carried some ventifacts to these low ribs and assembled them with their facets touching so that the ribs were heightened by just one or two rocks' height. Snowmelt would collect in meadow ponds banked by moss. The moors just east of Sabashi resembled what he had in mind, and he called up echo poets who lived on those moors and asked about species compatibility, growth rates, soil amendment, and the like. In his mind developed a vision of the basin. Then, in 2nd March, the autumn came, the year heading toward aphelion, and he began to see how much of the landscaping would be done by wind and winter. He would have to wait and see. He spread seeds and spores by hand, casting them away from bags or growth media dishes latched to his belt, feeling like a figure from Van Gogh or the Old Testament. It was a peculiar sensation of mixed power and helplessness, action and fate. He arranged for loads of topsoil to be trucked up and dumped on some of the little fields, and then he spread it out by hand, thinly. He brought in worms from the university farm at Sabashii. Worms in a bottle, Coyote had always called people in cities. Observing the writhing mass of moist, naked tubules, Nergal shuddered. He released the worms onto his new little plots. Go, little worm, prosper on the land. He himself, walking around on the sunny mornings after a shower, was no more than moist, linked, naked tubules. Sentient worms, that's what they were, in bottles or on the land. After the worms, it would be moles and voles, then mice, then snow rabbits and ermine and marmots. Perhaps then some of the snow cats wandering the moors would drop by, foxes. The basin was high, but the pressure they were hoping for at this altitude was 400 millibars, with 40% of that oxygen. They were already most of the way there. Conditions were somewhat as in the Himalayas. Presumably all of Earth's high-altitude flora and fauna would be viable here, and all the new engineered variants, and with so many eco-poets stewarding small patches of the upland, the problem would be mostly a matter of prepping the ground, introducing the basic ecosystem desired, and then supporting it and watching what came in on the wind or walked in or flew. These arrivals could be problematic, of course, and there was a lot of talk on the wrist about invasion biology and integrated microcline management. Figuring out one's locality's connections to the larger region was a big part of the ongoing work of ecopoiesis. Nergal got even more interested in this matter of dispersal the next spring, in 1st November when the snows melted, and poking out of the late slush on the flat terraces of the northern side of the basin were sprigs of snow alum root. He hadn't planted them. He had never heard of them. Indeed, he wasn't even sure of his identification until his neighbor Yoshi dropped by one week and confirmed it. Heuchera nivalis. Blown in on the wind, Yoshi said. There was a lot of it in Escalante crater to the north. Not much of it in between. But that was jump dispersal for you. Jump dispersal, spread dispersal, stream dispersal. All three were common on Mars. Mosses and bacteria were spread dispersing. Hydrophilic plants were stream dispersing along the sides of glaciers and the new coastlines. And lichen and any number of other plants were jump dispersing on the strong winds. Human dispersion showed all three patterns, Yoshi remarked as they wandered over the basin discussing the concept. Spreading through Europe and Asia and Africa. Streaming down the Americas and along the Australian coasts, jumping out to the Pacific Islands or to Mars. It was common to see all three methods used by highly adaptable species. And the Tarina Massif was up in the wind, catching the westerlies and also the summer trade winds, so that both sides of the massif got precipitation. Nowhere more than 20 centimeters a year, which would have made it desert on Earth. But in the southern hemisphere of Mars, that was a precipitation island. In that way, too, a dispersion catchment. And so, very invasible. So, high barren rocky land, dusted with snow wherever shade predominated, so that the shadows tended to be white. Little sign of life except in basins where the eco-poets helped along their little collections. Clouds surged in from west in the winter, east in the summer. The southern hemisphere had the seasons reinforced by the perihelion-aphelion cycle, so that they really meant something. On Tarina, the winters were hard. Nergal wandered the basin after storms, looking to see what had blown in. Usually it was only a load of icy dust. But once he found an unplanted clutch of pale blue Jacob's ladders tucked between the splits in a breadloaf rock. Checked the botanicals to see how it might interact with what was already there. 10% of introduced species survived. Then 10% of those became pests. That was invasion biology's 10-10 rule, Yoshi said, almost the first rule of the discipline. 10 meaning 5 to 20, of course. Once Nergal weeded out a springtime arrival of common street grass, fearing it would take over everything. Same with tundra thistle. Another time a heavy dust load fell on an autumn wind. These dust storms were small compared to the old global southern summer storms, but occasionally a hard wind would tear up the desert pavement somewhere and send the dust below flying. The atmosphere was thickening rapidly these days, 15 millibars a year on average. Each year the winds had more force, and so thicker areas of pavement were at risk of being torn away. The dust that fell was usually a very thin layer, however, and often high in nitrates, so it was like a fertilizer to be washed into the soil by the next rain. Nergal bought a position in the Sabashii construction co-op he had looked into. He went in often to work on the town's buildings. Up in the basin, he did some assembly and testing of solo blimp gliders. His work cottage was a small building made of stone-stacked walls with plates of sandstone for shingles. Between that work and the farming in the greenhouse and his potato patch and the ecopoesis in the basin, his days were full. He flew the completed blimp gliders down to Sabashii and stayed in a little studio above in his old teacher Tariki's rebuilt house in the old city, living there among ancient Issei who looked and sounded very much like Hiroko. Art and Nadia lived there too, raising their daughter, Nikki. Also in town were Vijika and Riel and Annette, all old friends from his student days, and there was the university itself, no longer called the University of Mars, but simply Sabashii College, a small school that still ran in the amorphous style of the Demimonde years, so that the more ambitious students went to Elysium or Sheffield or Cairo. Those who came to Sabashii were those fascinated by the mystique of the Demimonde years, or interested in the work of one of the Issei professors. All these people and activities made Nergal feel strangely, even uncomfortably, at home. He put in long days as a plasterer and general laborer on various construction jobs his co-op had around town. He ate in rice bars and pubs. He slept in the loft in Tariki's garage and looked forward to the days he returned to the basin. One night he was walking home late from a pub, asleep on his feet, when he passed a small man sleeping on a park bench. Coyote. Nergal stopped short. He walked over to the bench. He stared and stared. Some nights he heard coyotes howling up in the basin. This was his father. He remembered all those days hunting for Hiroko without a clue where to look. But here his father slept on a city park bench. Nergal could call him any time, and always that bright cracked grin, Trinidad itself. Tears started to his eyes. He shook his head, composed himself. Old man lying on a park bench. One saw it fairly frequently. A lot of the Issei had gotten here and gone off somehow, into the back country for good, so that when they came into a city they slept in the parks. Nergal went over and sat on the end of the bench, just beyond his father's head. Gray, tatty dreadlocks. Like a drunk. Nergal just sat with him, looking at the undersides of the linden trees around the bench. It was a quiet night. Stars ticked through the leaves. Coyote stirred, twisted his head, and glanced up.
Who dat?
Hey, Nergal said.
Hey,
Coyote said, and sat up. He rubbed at his eyes.
Nergal, man, you startled me there.
Sorry, I was walking by and saw you. What are you doing?
Sleeping.
Ha ha. Well, I was. Far as I know, that was all I was doing. Coyote, don't you have a home?
Why, no.
Doesn't that bother you?
No.
Coyote bleared a grin at him.
I'm like that awful vid program. The world is my home.
Nergal only shook his head. Coyote squinted as he saw that Nergal was not amused. He stared at him for a long time from under half-mast eyelids, breathing deeply.
My boy,
he said at last, dreamily. The whole city was quiet. Coyote muttered as if falling asleep.
What does the hero do when the tale is over? Swim over the waterfall. Drift out on the tide.
What? Coyote opened his eyes fully, leaned toward Nergal.
Do you remember when we brought Sax into Tharsis Tholis and you sat with him, and afterward they said you brought him back to life? That kind of thing. Think about that.
He shook his head, leaned back on the bench.
It's not right. It's just a story. Why worry about that story when it's not yours anyway? What you're doing right now is better. You can walk away from that kind of story. Sit in a park at night like any ordinary person. Go anywhere you please.
Nergal nodded, uncertain.
What I like to do, Coyote said sleepily, is go to a sidewalk cafe and toss down some kava and watch all the faces. Go for a walk around the streets and look at people's faces. I like to look at women's faces. So beautiful. And some of them so something, I don't know. I love them.
He was falling asleep again.
You'll find your way to live.
Guests who occasionally visited him in the basin included Sax, Coyote, Art, and Nadia and Nikki, who got taller every year. She was taller than Nadia already, and seemed to regard Nadia as a nanny or a great-grandmother, much as Nergal himself had regarded her in Zygote. Nikki had inherited Art's sense of fun, and Art himself encouraged this, egging her on, conspiring with her against Nadia, watching her with the most radiant pleasure Nergal had ever seen on an adult face. Once Nergal saw the three of them sitting on the stone wall by his potato patch, laughing helplessly at something Art had said, and he felt a pang even as he too laughed. His old friends were now married with a kid, living in that most ancient pattern. Faced with that, his life on the land didn't seem so substantial after all. But what could he do? Only a few people in this world were lucky enough to run into their true partners. It took outrageous luck for it to happen, then the sense to recognize it and the courage to act. Few could be expected to have all that, and then to have things go well. The rest had to make do. So he lived in his high basin, grew some of his food, worked on co-op projects to pay for the rest. He flew down to Sabashii once a month in a new aircraft, enjoyed his stay of a week or two, and went back home. Art and Nadia and Sax came up frequently, and much less often he hosted Maya and Michelle, or Spencer, all of whom lived in Odessa, or Zake and Nazik, who brought news of Cairo and Mangala that he tried not to hear. When they left, he went out onto the arcing ridge and sat on one of his sitting boulders and looked at the meadows stringing through the talus, concentrating on what he had, on this world of the senses, rock and lichen and moss campion. The basin was evolving. There were moles in the meadows, marmots in the talus. At the end of the long winters, the marmots came out of hibernation early, nearly starving, their internal clocks still set to earth. Nergal set out food for them in the snow and watched from his house's upper windows as they ate it. They needed help to get through the long winters to spring. They regarded his house as a source of food and warmth, and two marmot families lived in the rocks under it, whistling their warning whistle when anyone approached. Once they warned him of people from the Tarina Committee on the introduction of new species, asking him for a species list and a rough census. They were beginning to formulate a local native inhabitant list which, once formed, would allow them to make judgments on any subsequent introductions of fast-spreading species. Nergal was happy to join this effort, and apparently so was everyone else doing ecopoesis on the massif. As a precipitation island, hundreds of kilometers from the nearest others, they were developing their own mix of high-altitude fauna and flora, and there was a growing sentiment to regard this mix as natural to Tarina, to be altered only by consensus. The group from the committee left, and Nergal sat with the house marmots, feeling odd. "Well," he said to them, "now we're indigenous." He was happy in his basin, above the world and its concerns. In the spring, new plants appeared from nowhere, and some he greeted with a trowel of compost, others he plucked out and turned into compost. The greens of spring were unlike any other greens, light electric jades and limes of bud and leaf, new blades of emerald grass, blue nettles, red leaves. And then later, the flowers, that tremendous expense of plant's energy, the push beyond survival, the reproductive urge all around him. Sometimes, when Nadia and Nikki came back from their walks, holding miniature bouquets in their big hands, it seemed to Nergal that the world made sense. He would eye them and think about children, and feel some wild edge in him that wasn't usually there. It was a feeling generally shared, apparently. Spring lasted 143 days in the southern hemisphere, coming all the way back from the harsh aphelion winter. More plants bloomed as the spring months passed, first early ones like promise of spring and snow liverwort, then later ones such as phlox and heather, then saxifrage and Tibetan rhubarb, moss campion and alpine nailwort, cornflowers and edelweiss, on and on until every patch of green carpet in the rocky palm of the basin was touched with brilliant dots of cyanic blue, dark pink, yellow, white, each color waving in a layer at the characteristic height of the plant holding it, all of them glowing in the dusk like drips of light, welling out into the world from nowhere. A pointillist Mars. The ribbiness of the seamed basin etched in the air by this scree of color. He stood in a cupped rock hand which tilted its snowmelt down a lifeline crease in the palm, down into the wide world so far below, a vast, shadowy world that loomed to the west under the sun, all hazy and low. The last light of day seemed to shine slightly upward. One clear morning, Jackie appeared on his house AI screen and announced she was on the piste from Odessa to Libya and wanted to drop by. Nergal agreed before he had time to think. He went down to the path by the outlet stream to greet her. Little High Basin. There were a million craters like it in the south. Little Old Impact. Nothing the slightest bit distinguished about it. He remembered Shining Mesa, the stupendous yellow view at dawn. They came up in three cars, bouncing wildly over the terrain, like kids. Jackie was driving the first car, Antar the second. They were laughing hard as they got out. Antar didn't seem to mind losing the race. They had a whole group of young Arabs with them. Jackie and Antar looked young themselves, amazingly so. It had been a long time since Nergal had seen them, but they hadn't changed at all. The treatments. Current folk wisdom was to get it done early and often, ensuring perpetual youth and balking any of the rare diseases that still killed people from time to time. Balking death entirely, perhaps. Early, often. They still looked like they were 15 years old. But Jackie was a year older than Nergal, and he was almost 33 years old now and feeling older. Looking at their laughing faces, he thought, I'll have to get the treatment myself some day. So they wandered around, stepping on the grass and oohing and aahing at the flowers, and the basin seemed smaller and smaller with every exclamation they made. Near the end of their visit, Jackie took him to one side, looking serious. She said, We're having trouble holding off the Terrans, Nergal. They're sending up almost 1 million a year, just like you said they never could. And these new arrivals aren't joining Free Mars like they used to. They're still supporting their home governments. Mars isn't changing them fast enough. If this goes on, then the whole idea of a Free Mars will be a joke. I sometimes wonder if it was a mistake to leave the cable up. She frowned, and 20 years jumped onto her face all at once. Nergal suppressed a little shudder. It would help if you weren't hiding here, she exclaimed with sudden anger, dismissing the basin with a wave of her hand. We need everyone we can get to help. People still remember you now, but in a few years... So he only had to wait a few more years, he thought. He watched her. She was beautiful, yes. But beauty was a matter of the spirit, of intelligence, vivacity, empathy, so that while Jackie grew ever more beautiful, at the same time she grew less beautiful. Another mysterious enfolding. And Nergal wasn't pleased by this internal loss in Jackie, not in any way. It was only one more note in the chord of his Jackie Payne, really. He didn't want it to be true. "We can't really help them by taking more immigrants," she said. "That was wrong when you said that on Earth. They know it, too. They can see it better than we can, no doubt. But they send people anyway, and you know why? You know why? Just to wreck things here, just to make sure there isn't some place where people are doing it right. That's their only reason." Nergal shrugged. He didn't know what to say. Probably there was some truth to what she had said, but it was just one of a million different reasons for people to come. There was no reason to fix on it. "So you won't come back," she said at last. "You don't care." Nergal shook his head. How to say to her that she wasn't worried about Mars, but about her own power? He wasn't the one who could tell her that. She wouldn't believe him. And maybe it was only true to him, anyway. Abruptly, she stopped trying to reach him. A regal glance at Antar, and Antar did the work of gathering their coterie into the cars. A final questioning look, a kiss, full on the mouth, no doubt to bother Antar, or him, or both of them. Like an electric shock to the soul. And she was off. He spent the afternoon and the next day wandering, sitting on the flat rocks and watching the little rivulets bounce downstream. Once he remembered how fast water had fallen on Earth. Unnatural. No. But this was his place, known and loved, every dyad and every clump of campion, even the speed of water as it lofted off stone and plashed down in its smooth silver shapes. The way moss felt under the finger pads. His visitors were people for whom Mars was forever an idea, a nascent state, a political situation. They lived in the tents, and they might as well have been in a city anywhere, and their devotion, while real, was given to some cause or idea, some Mars of the mind, which was fine. But for Nergal now, it was the land that mattered. The places where water arrived just so, trickling over the billion-year-old rock onto pads of new moss. Leave politics to the young. He had done his part. He didn't want to do any more. Or at least he wanted to wait until Jackie was gone. Power was like Hiroko, after all. It always slipped away. Didn't it? Meanwhile, the Cirque, like an open hand. But then one morning, when he went out for a dawn walk, there was something different. The sky was clear, its purest morning purple, but a juniper's needles had a yellowish tinge to them, and so did the moss and the potato leaves on their mounds. He plucked the yellowest samples of needles and sprigs and leaves, and took them back to the workbench in his greenhouse. 2 hours' work with microscope and AI didn't find any problem, and he went back out and pulled up some root samples and bagged some more needles and leaves and blades and flowers. Much of the grass had a wilted look, though it wasn't a hot day. Heart thudding, stomach taut, he worked all day and into the night. He could discover nothing. No insects, no pathogens. But the potato leaves in particular looked yellow. That night he called Sax and explained the situation. By coincidence, Sax was visiting the university in Sabishii, and he drove up the next morning in a little rover, the latest from Spencer's co-op. "Nice," Sax said as he got out and looked around. He checked Nergal's samples in the greenhouse. He said. "I wonder." He had brought some instruments in his car, and they lugged them into the boulder, and he went to work. At the end of a long day, he said, "I can't find anything. We'll have to take some samples down to Sabishii." "You can't find anything?" "No pathogen, no bacteria, no virus." He shrugged. "Let's take several potatoes." They went out and dug potatoes from the field. Some of them were gnarled, elongated, cracked. "What is it?" Nergal exclaimed. Sax was frowning a little. Looks like spindle tuber disease.
What causes it?
A viroid.
What's that?
A bare RNA fragment. Smallest known infectious agent. Strange.
Ka.
Nergal felt his stomach clamping inward.
How did it get here?
On a parasite, probably. This kind seems to be infecting grass. We need to find out.
So they gathered samples and drove back down to Sabashii.
Nergal sat on a futon on the floor of Tariki's living room, feeling sick. Tariki and Sax talked long after dinner, discussing the situation. Other viroids had been appearing in a rapid dispersal from Tharsis. Apparently, they had made it across the cordon sanitaire of space, arriving on a world that had been previously innocent of them. They were smaller than viruses, much smaller, and quite a bit simpler. Nothing but strands of RNA, Tariki said, about 50 nanometers long. Individuals had a molecular weight of about 130,000, while the smallest known viruses had molecular weights of over 1 million. They were so small that they had to be centrifuged at over 100,000 G in order to be pulled out of suspension. The potato spindle tuber viroid was well understood, Tariki told them, tapping around on his screen and pointing at the schematics called up. A chain of merely 359 nucleotides lined out in a closed single strand with short double-strand regions braiding it. Viroids like this one caused several plant diseases, including pale cucumber disease, chrysanthemum stunt, chlorotic mottle, Chadang, Citrus exocortis. Viroids had also been confirmed as the agent in some animal brain diseases, like scrapie and kuru and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans. The viroids used host enzymes to reproduce, and then were taken to be regulatory molecules in the nuclei of infected cells, disturbing growth hormone production in particular. The particular viroid in Nergal's basin, Tariki said, had mutated from potato spindle tuber. They were still identifying it in the labs at the university, but the sick grass made him sure they were going to find something different, something new. Nergal felt sick. The names of the diseases alone were enough to do it. He stared at his hands, which had been plunged thick in infected plants. Through the skin, into the brain, some kind of spongiform encephalopathy, mushroom growths of brain blooming everywhere. Is there anything we can do to fight it? He said. Sax and Tariki looked at him.
First, Sax said, we have to find out what it is.
That turned out to be no simple matter. After a few days, Nergal returned to his basin. There he could at least do something. Sax had suggested removing all the potatoes from the potato fields. This was a long, dirty task, a kind of negative treasure hunt, as he turned up diseased tuber after tuber. Presumably the soil itself would still hold the viroid. It was possible he would have to abandon the field or even the basin, at best plant something else. No one yet understood how viroids reproduced, and the word from Sabashii was that this might not even be a viroid as previously understood.
It's a shorter strand than usual, Sax said. Either a new viroid or something like a viroid, but smaller still.
In the Sabashii labs, they were calling it the virid. A long week later, Sax came back up to the basin.
We can try to remove it physically, he said over dinner. Then plant different species, ones that are resistant to viroids. That's the best we can do.
But will that work?
The plants susceptible to infection are fairly specific. You got hit by a new one, but if you change grasses and types of potatoes, perhaps cycle out some of your potato patch soil.
Sax shrugged. Nergal ate with more appetite than he had had for the previous week. Even the suggestion of a possible solution was a great relief. He drank some wine, felt better and better. "These things are strange, eh?" he said over an after-dinner brandy. "What life will come up with?"
"If you call it life."
"Well, of course." Sax didn't reply.
"I've been looking at the news on the net," Nergal said. "There are a lot of infestations I had never noticed before. Parasites, viruses."
"Yes. Sometimes I worry about a global plague. Something we can't stop."
"Ka! Could that happen?"
"There's all kinds of invasions going on. Population surges, sudden die-offs, all over. Things in disequilibrium, upsetting balances we didn't even know existed. Things we don't understand."
As always, this thought made Sax unhappy.
"Biomes will eventually come into equilibrium," Nergal suggested.
"I'm not sure there is such a thing."
"As equilibrium?"
"Yes. It may be a matter of..." He waved his hands about like gulls. "Punctuated equilibrium, without the equilibrium."
"Punctuated change?"
"Perpetual change. Braided change. Sometimes surging change."
"Like cascading recombinants?"
"Perhaps."
"I've heard that's a mathematics only a dozen people can really understand."
Sax looked surprised.
"That's never true, or else true of every math."
"Depends on what you mean by understand.
But I know a bit of that one. You can use it to model some of this stuff, but not predict. And I don't know how to use it to suggest any reactions on our part. I'm not sure it can be used that way."
He talked for a while about Vlad's notion of holons, which were organic units that had subunits and also were subunits of greater holons, each level combining to create the next one up in emergent fashion all the way up and down the great chain of being. Vlad had worked out mathematical descriptions of these emergences, which turned out to come in more than one kind, with different families of properties for each kind. So if they could get enough information about the behavior of a level of holons and the next level up, they could try to fit them into these mathematical formulae and see what kind of emergence they had, then perhaps find ways to disrupt it.
"That's the best approach we can take for things this little,"